It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. You know, there are many troubled places on Earth, so it really caught our attention last week when the author and activist Eve Ensler was on the show and talked about Congo as, by many measures, being the worst place on Earth. Here's 45 seconds of Eve Ensler.
Well, I just want to say that I think what's happened there, because of this escalation of this pillaging of minerals and this desperation for the goods, there's all these outside militias from Rwanda, from Uganda, from Burundi, and that have influenced the Congolese army as well, to see women's bodies now as this kind of desecrated landscape. So, you know, I've heard stories now of 9-month-old babies being gang raped, of 8-year-old girls being desecrated, of 80-year-old women having their legs ripped out of their socks as they're being raped, of cannibalism, of just things that are so, and because there is no world community that's intervening and in a significant way, these crimes not only continue, but they are allowed to get more grotesque.
So Eve Ensler talking about her new book on our show last week. That memoir is about her battle with cancer and her battle for women's rights in Congo. And in a world of so many troubled countries, it's incredible to hear anything described as the worst country in the world, almost on any measure. So let's follow up. As it turns out, Save the Children issues an annual State of Motherhood report. And probably because Eve Ensler had me thinking about Congo, I noticed that Save the Children listed it as the worst place in the world to give birth. The best place was Finland, according to Save the Children. As for the United States, shockingly bad among industrialized countries for the risk that a baby will die on the day that it's born. So let's find out more from Dr. Joy Lawn, professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the lead researcher for Save the Children's State of the World's Mothers Report. Hello, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure, and good day to all your listeners.
And let's start at the bottom and work our way up. Why is Congo the worst place in the world to give birth?
Well, as someone who was born in Africa and actually nearly died in Africa, unfortunately, all the bottom 20 countries in this list are African countries, apart from Afghanistan and Pakistan. So we can see that conflict anywhere, the Congo or anywhere in the world, it's women and babies who suffer the most.
Is it conflict? You just said conflict. Is it poverty or is it conflict?
These countries, the bottom 20 countries, are ones that have been specifically affected by conflict. Also Somalia, Chad, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and a number of other African countries. So the index is based on 5 metrics. One metric is the chance of a mother dying during pregnancy and labor. And in Congo, 1 in 30 women have in their lifetime a risk of dying.
That's just a staggering statistic that we have to linger on for a moment, because it's the kind of thing that could go by and then we forget about it and we go and make tea and whatever. 1 in 30 births result in the death of the mother?
Yes. And I mean, the double risk is the number of births you have as well. So if there's no access to family planning, or women are not empowered to choose how many births they want and have multiple births, and then each birth is risky, then that really stacks the chances against women, and a high proportion of births happening at home without skilled care.
Each subsequent birth is riskier.
Indeed. I mean, particularly if you're starting as an adolescent, that's very risky. And then if you don't have family planning, you know, many countries in Africa still have a high fertility rate. Maybe a woman may have an average of 6 births. So she's still having births at the end of her reproductive lifespan, which in fact is an even riskier time period than as a teenager.
Which, at the risk of going on a tangent that's controversial, the anti-abortion movement is always trying to remind people that there is a risk of dying from a botched abortion, especially in the developing world. But these Congo childbirth, death in childbirth stats make me think it must be much riskier to a woman's health to go through pregnancy and childbirth than to have an abortion. Are there comparative numbers on that?
Well, I think also in Congo, both would be a risky procedure. So I really think, and this is something I've worked for Save the Children for the last decade, it's a lot about girls' education, empowering girls and access to family planning. That's what would really make the difference.
And you talk about lack of access to sophisticated medical care. We're often reminded in this country that with our medicalized childbirth in hospital rooms, that childbirth is a natural act, and women have been doing it for, well, millions of years without heart monitors and Pitocin and all that other stuff. So did they used to know something in Congo that they forgot, or was childbirth always a pretty risky business and we shouldn't romanticize natural childbirth too much?
You know, childbirth is a wonderful moment, but around the world for women and for babies, it's also the riskiest moment. I mean, that's the highest chance of a baby dying. So this report highlights a new analysis for chance of dying on the first day that you're born. And around the world, 1 million babies die on the day that they're born. But what we didn't highlight in the press report, but because you're obviously a very thoughtful person and your listeners are, just to add that a really important issue is there are babies who die during labour. So around the world, there are 1.2 million babies who die. The woman goes into labour with a live baby, and the baby dies during the process of labour. And that highlights that although labour is natural, it's pretty dangerous. Mm-hmm. It is dangerous. And, you know, here in the US, we worry about having too many cesarean sections. But in rural West Africa, the cesarean section rate is zero, effectively. So we live in a crazy world where if you could redistribute cesarean sections, yes. Brazil 53%, send a few to places where women are dying because of obstructed labor or having fistula, and where many millions of babies are dying needlessly.
If we could only rationally distribute the cesareans. Dr. Joy Lawn, my guest on WNYC, lead researcher for Save the Children's State of the World's Mothers Report. We can take a few phone calls for her, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. And just to give people an idea of the range, if a woman giving birth in Congo, the riskiest country, has a 1 in 30 chance of dying in childbirth, that contrasts with the safest place, Finland, where the chances of dying in childbirth are more than 1 in 12,000. Mm. So that's just a heck of a range.
It is. It is. And the Scandinavian countries always come out top. Top five countries, Scandinavian countries, top 20 are Northern European plus Australia and New Zealand.
And it's always that way. It seems like whether we're talking about the happiness index or dying in childbirth or whatever it is, Scandinavia comes out on top.
Well, I think Bhutan did well in the happiness index. But I think the index also reflects more than just a woman's chance of dying. We also look at the context for women. So, in fact, one of the things that the Scandinavian countries do better than some other countries, including England, where I'm living now, is a higher proportion of women in parliament. So our five metrics in this Mother's Day index are the woman's chance of survival, the baby's chance of survival to their fifth birthday, education, income, and then women in parliament. And in fact, interestingly, the country with the highest reported percentage of women in parliament is Rwanda.
Huh.
And interestingly to me, who spent the last 20 years studying how we can do better for newborn deaths, and particularly in Africa, Rwanda is progressing the fastest for reducing newborn deaths of almost any country in the world at the moment.
That's a fascinating correlation. And of course, these disparities, when we're talking about from 1 in 30 deaths in childbirth to 1 in 12,000, that kind of disparity should not exist among human beings. So do you make policy recommendations at Save the Children to reduce that disparity?
We make policy recommendations, but we realize that to make policy change, you have to work with many, many partners. So yesterday we had a very exciting event at the UN hosted by the ambassador for Zambia, who is a medical doctor. And in fact, the first lady in Zambia at the moment is an obstetrician. So those policy recommendations aren't just something that the UN should take up. It's for national governments around the world and also the voice of civil society. This morning, excitingly, there's an event in Tribeca with hundreds of mums, I have to say moms in this country, I think, meeting for Mums Plus Social. We have a number of high-profile celebrities, Jennifer Lopez, coming in to talk about the power of the voice of women. And I think this is something we have lacked. So around the world, women have really raised their voice for maternal deaths and maternal rights. But I don't think we've spoken enough also for the rights of our children, and especially for newborns. So newborns in Africa and around the world, 3 million babies dying in the first month of life. Very little media coverage. That's more than HIV deaths. It's considerably more than malaria, and we just don't hear about it.
So we've talked about some of the most tragic of the tragic. Let's turn our attention to the United States. The Save the Children State of Motherhood report includes stats for the first time, I gather, this year on infant deaths on the first day of life. Mm-hmm. Infant deaths on the first day of life. That's a cheery topic. And it finds that the U.S. has 38% of all the births in the industrialized world, but 60% of all the deaths of babies on the day they are born. In other mm-hmm. words, the first day of life death rate is much higher in the United States than most other developed countries. Where exactly do we stand on that list? Do you have it?
Yes, I do. So the U.S. has a risk of around 3 per 1,000 of babies dying on the first day of life. So that translates into more than 11,000 women in the U.S. So we're coming to Mother's Day on Sunday. But there are 11,000 women every year and fathers and the rest of the family who, when the baby is born, that baby dies on their birthday. So instead of a happy first birthday, it's a lost day.
Are there preventable causes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are two, you know, reasons to explain why the U.S. accounts for such a big proportion of first day deaths around the world. One is that the U.S. population is big. A bigger number of births happening here than
right.
in
but
many
we're
other
talking
countries.
About a rate.
But the rate and the risk is much higher. So there are 68 countries that have a rate of 2 or less, and the U.S. has a rate of 3, and actually, you know, quite close to 3. And that's because, first of all, neonatal deaths, so newborn deaths in the first month of life in the U.S. are higher than many other industrialized countries. And then within those first month deaths, they're really stacked on the first day. And we believe a lot of that is, and this is the U.S.'s own data, it's not, you know, modeled estimates, it's reported data from the U.S. A lot of it is likely to be related to the major cause of deaths on the first day, which is preterm birth, being born too soon. And the U.S. has an extremely high rate of preterm birth, almost the highest in the industrialized world. 12% of babies in the U.S. are born preterm, 500,000 a year.
Why here, with all our advanced medical care available?
Good question. I mean, this is 3 times the rate of Finland, double the rate of the U.K., and it really, I mean, it appears to have plateaued in the last year or so. March of Dimes, which is based here in New York, has done fantastic work on scorecards around the states. And, you know, what we can see, too, is there's a lot of difference across the states. So causes of preterm birth, I mean, some of the increase has been things like older women having births, increased rate in C-section, lifestyle conditions, so obesity, diabetes, hypertension are all risk factors. Artificial assisted reproductive technology, so implanting multiple embryos, all mm-hmm. of these have an effect. But the reality is around 50% of the increase in the U.S. can't be explained by all those factors.
How about access to care? For all the debate over Obamacare
right.
here, I think access to prenatal care is relatively good. But mm-hmm. did you rate that?
Well, in fact, you know, prenatal care, we haven't got lots of things that we can roll out in prenatal care that make a big difference in the U.S. for preterm birth. In around Africa, you know, dealing with malaria in pregnancy, dealing with high rates of HIV and STIs. But the big thing for preterm birth that we have focused most of medical energy on is looking after preterm babies when they come out. And if you're a preterm baby born in the US, you know, even at very low gestational age, a 23, 24 weeker, your chances of survival are good. But because the US has twice the rate, the catch, you know, just running to catch up all the time.
Dr. Joan Lond, my guest, the lead researcher for Save the Children's new State of the World's Mothers Report, 212-433-WNYC, and Janet in Manhattan. You're on the air. Hi, Janet.
Oh, hi. Yes, I wanted to say something or ask a question, really, about Australia. But while I was waiting, you said, Brian, why the rates are so high here. Don't we have really good prenatal care? Well, yes, if you can afford it. If you are without insurance, there was a documentary that Surgeon General Koop did in 1993 around the time of the Clinton plan being discussed, and he interviewed a woman. She was 8.5 months pregnant. She lived in Hawaii. She had Medicaid. Supposedly she's insured. She called every OBGYN on her island. No one would see her. She didn't see a doctor once. She was about to deliver in 2 weeks, had not seen a doctor once. But that's not really what I called it that. I wanted to ask.
Right, and I actually think that that's improved a lot since then, and with the CHIP program and particular maternal health programs, that there's pretty good access, but we should double check this and see what the holes still are with respect to prenatal care.
Right.
But Janet, go ahead. You wanted to ask about Australia, right?
Yeah, I'd heard something very interesting, and it's related because it does deal with what happens in a country where you do have national health insurance. What they do in Australia, first of all, they keep you in the hospital for 2 weeks after you deliver, and the reason they do that is because it takes about 2 weeks usually for postpartum depression to show up, so they're monitoring women for that. And then they let you go home, and then they send a nurse, and I don't know for how long they do this, but for the first few months at least, when you go home, they send a nurse to your home periodically to check up on you, the baby, how you're doing, how's the baby doing, and I'm wondering how that ties into the good survival rates that babies have in Australia.
Janet, thank you. Are you familiar with that program? Is it as she describes, as far as you know?
Yeah, no, thanks, Janet. And I think it's key, the issue of universal access, especially for women and children. I think this is something that, it's not acceptable if pregnant women and babies aren't protected by society. In Australia, I'm not sure about keeping in hospital for 2 weeks. I do know that in the Australian, New Zealand and European systems, they encourage the first 24 hours especially. But the key point that you raised about visiting at home.
Mothers don't want to stay in the hospital for 2 weeks after they give birth.
No.
If they don't have to.
But I think the point you raised about visiting at home is a fantastic one. So certainly in the UK, a midwife will come and visit you at home every day for 10 days and then hand you over to a health visitor after that. And that midwife checks you, checks the baby, but also listens to you and looks out for things like postnatal depression. That's fantastic. And in fact, around the world, we're now using community health workers to visit women at home. Ethiopia, Malawi, India, Nepal, many countries are now doing this at scale and is starting to make a difference for mothers and babies' survival.
Janet, thank you. We're just about out of time. But before you go, and by the way, there's a New York Times article being widely shared on social media right now about how babies have lower rates of asthma and allergies, also eczema, if parents suck the baby's pacifiers clean rather than wash them in a sink or boil them. This is – a lot of people are reading this article right these last few days. So whether that sounds appetizing or not, do you think
it's
medically true?
I would go for breastfeeding them. we have a huge science around exclusive breastfeeding of babies reducing asthma and also improving IQ and so on. So
the answer is none of the above. Avoid the pacifiers
breastfeed,
right?
Absolutely. I would go for that. And I hope that your listeners would be able to look at the report in more detail and read about the U.S. So at savethechildren.org, the report is there. And also use your voice for women and babies in the U.S., but also around the world.
Save the Children's State of the World's Mothers Report just out. Dr. Joy Lawn was the lead researcher, and she's a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Thank you so much for talking about this with
us. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, while you're home, Emily Matcher, author of Homeward Bound, Why Women Are Embracing the New Domesticity. And she'll examine this new sort of extreme domesticity movement and why so many women are going home to knit, pickle, and blog about it. And what does it mean for gender equality? Stay with us.